talk. Allow them to tell you their problems and troubles. Take notes. Ask questions. Truly understand their problems. That's all? No. You are then going to sit with their problems and create potential solutions. Your solutions will be converted into proposals you make to them. You will solve their problems for them. The fastest way to create wealth for your consulting business is to find someone with a problem and solve it. What about marketing? Solve enough problems and you'll never need it. They'll refer other people to you who also have problems. People start their day wondering how to make more money. That's a futile approach. They would make more money if they started their day searching for other people's problems. Number 62. Play 20 questions. George Gilder said, quote, "A successful economy depends on the proliferation of the rich, on creating a large class of risk-taking men and women who are willing to shun the easy channels of a comfortable life in order to create new enterprise, win huge profits, and invest them again." End quote. Even if you are not in business right now, it makes sense to ask every business person that you interact with how he or she does it. Ask about the market, how their business works, frustrations in their business, great points about their business, just to know. Sam says, "A lot of the progress I've made in my business has been by asking other people questions about how they do things and seeing whether it's a good thing they're doing, a bad thing they're doing, and what can I learn from this?" And even people in businesses that aren't doing well, it's instructive to get information from them. Sam remembers talking to someone who ran a health food store a few years ago, and unfortunately, they were stuck in the whole victim mode of "there's nothing I can do." Sam just started asking them about the health food business, and the owner started telling him countless stories about how the grocery stores are all starting to carry health food right now, so it was really tough to compete. He didn't see that there was a huge opportunity to do things like home delivery and focus on the one part of the market that grocery stores couldn't focus on. This was right around the same time that we had a company delivering fresh organic produce to our house every week, and that was their unique service. But there was no one in the local market doing it, and I was wondering why this guy couldn't deliver organic produce and have a shop-at-home service and do things that the big grocery stores wouldn't do. So visiting with him was stimulating, even though he was failing. You can always activate the cross-pollination effect. Other businesses are doing things that your business might not be doing, and no one in your industry is doing. Even when you go to your association meetings or your franchise meetings, you read your industry magazine or you look on your industry website, it's never there. But it's being done over there in a different industry, and if you apply it to yours, you'd have a breakthrough. That's why asking questions at every business you visit will lead to wealth and inspiration. When I checked into hotels on my speaking tours, I would always ask the managers questions. I found out that some hotel chains had looked at how airlines gave out frequent flyer miles and decided to do their own frequent visitor programs with benefits to customer loyalty. They could have looked for decades at their own industry and never found that idea. These kinds of things come up when you play 20 questions with other business owners that you talk to. There is a warning, however, when you play this game. Don't believe them when they start talking about all the things that are holding them back from success. Don't get lured into that. You don't want to catch that victim virus. When you talk to a business owner with a lot of victim stories, be sure to wash your hands before leaving. By asking questions everywhere you go, you can't help but learn. And, as the great motivational teacher Jim Rohn says, quote, learning is the beginning of wealth. Learning is the beginning of health. Learning is the beginning of spirituality. Searching and learning is where the miracle process all begins. End quote. Number 63. Don't seek money up front. Thomas Edison said, quote, when you have exhausted all possibilities, remember this, you haven't. End quote. We don't want to come across like we're saying, get rich while you sleep, no money down. But the truth is, you don't need money to make money. There was a review of our Nine Lies book in a newspaper that said, one of the lies kind of tries to stretch it a bit, because it says, you should treat your customers well and use the open hand and spend money on them, but then it also says that you don't need money to make money. But if you don't need money to make money, where are you going to get money to spend on your customers? By selling your service. Maybe that's why newspapers are going out of business. Most successful businesses today were started with a very small amount of money, if any. Larry Farrell is a leading expert on entrepreneurial behavior. And he says a typical startup business now starts with less than $12,000, and a majority of small business starts now are actually financed by people using a single credit card to do so. A lot of our coaching clients go into various forms of consulting, healthcare consulting, personal training consulting, life coaching consulting, all different kinds of consulting. Some of them took Tom Peters' advice to quit the company you're working for and let them hire you back as a consultant. The way they start their business is not by finding money and then opening an office. They start by finding a client. Then they sit down and negotiate with the client for a prepayment for a year's worth of services, and that's their seed money. It's from an existing client. So you need clients to make money, you need customers to make money, you don't need money to make money. One of the people we were advising recently had no credit or bad credit, and she needed to get a certain amount of money to make the jump from running a small part-time business out of her house to actual commercial space. Finally, she offered her clients a prepay arrangement where they would pay for a year in advance. And of course, she was borrowing from herself, but it was better than not being able to borrow at all. So the whole I need money to make money approach is just wrong. You just need to be willing to sell to make money, because that's how the money's going to be made anyway. You might as well do it up front. If it's unearned money you get from an investor, who knows if you can actually turn it into more? But if you have the ability to sell the initial clients on paying you that money, then you can definitely do well. Earned money is stronger than borrowed or invested money every time. Number 64. Win by one stroke. Nathaniel Brandon said, quote, we evolve not by dreaming of giant steps, but by committing ourselves in action to little ones, moving step by relentless step in an ever-expanding field of vision. End quote. In golf, if you win by one stroke, you can get millions of dollars in prize money, but for second place, you'll just get a fraction of that. A single stroke is all it takes in life, too. A lot of people become preoccupied and think it takes so much more. They think they have to be much, much better than everyone else to succeed. But the truth is, you just have to win by one stroke. One gentle little swing and you're in. You just have to be slightly preferred by your customer over someone else. And the same is true if you work in an organization and want that promotion. you just have to be slightly preferred over the other person. And you can be preferred by one small stroke, that one stroke of courtesy or kindness you put into your work that others don't, and you win. It's the small differences you make that catapult you ahead. While others struggle to succeed, always thinking of the differences they would like to make but can't, you can win. Just move to the differences you can make. The smaller, the better. Billionaire Warren Buffett says the reason he succeeded financially was, quote, "I didn't look to jump over 7-foot bars. I looked around for 1-foot bars that I could step over," end quote. Number 65. Choose one thing to do. Peter McGargy Brown said, quote, "He who makes time precious lives forever," end quote. Winning by one stroke means managing your time so that when you stand over the ball, there's nothing in your mind but that one stroke. That's what they say separates Tiger Woods from the rest of the field. When the rest of the field stands over a ball, they think of 10 different things. How far behind am I? Is this really the right club? How can I forget that last bad hole? Tiger is different. He's just doing one thing. He's just putting a good shot on the ball he's hitting right now. That's it. The ultimate life management system. Many people in this chaotic, fast-paced world ask us to coach them on time management. How do I manage my time better? How do I get everything done? What can I do when I have too much to do? The ultimate time management system, the one Tiger uses, is to just hit the ball you're standing over. Thomas Merton was a monk, theologian, poet, and author of more than 50 books before his young life was cut short by an accidental electrocution. He ironically died by trying to do two things at once, stepping out of a bathtub and adjusting a poorly grounded electric fan. But his beautiful spiritual books live on today. We love Merton's quotation on this subject of doing too much. Quote, "To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is to succumb to violence. More than that, it is cooperation in violence. The frenzy of the activist neutralizes his work for peace. It destroys his own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of his own work, because it kills the root of inner wisdom which makes work fruitful." End quote. I'll never forget the woman who came up to me in one of my seminars. She had a copy of Reinventing Yourself, which had been passed out to everyone in the room, and she said, "I'm really offended by the title of this book, Reinventing Yourself." And I said, "How does it offend you?" And she said, "Well, it makes me think that there's something wrong with me, that I have to reinvent myself. Why should I have to think that? Why do I always have to fix myself? Do I really?" I said, "No, of course you don't. And when you read the book, you'll see that the book itself is based on the premise that people reinvent themselves faster when they have the courage to see that there's nothing wrong with them, nothing whatsoever. That's step one in joyful reinvention." Most people come into our coaching conversations and training seminars with a laundry list of things that they think are wrong with them, including numerous personal limitations. Therefore, and this is a hard thing for people to see, when they have the courage to really admit deep down that there's nothing wrong with them whatsoever, that's when they take off. That's when they can reinvent themselves in a newly prosperous way. Eleanor Roosevelt said, "No one can make me feel inferior without my permission." That's ownership. That's owning your own spirit, and that's the key to time management. In any given moment, we are either owners or victims. Ownership is high consciousness. We can see the big picture. While victimization, on the other hand, has us being victims of circumstance. Soon we're overwhelmed with too many things to do. We don't have time to do them. But when we're in the ownership position, we're in a position mentally to utilize the ultimate time management system of doing one thing and only one. When we're in a victim position, we feel overwhelmed and swamped. The victim says, "I'm swamped. I'm overwhelmed. The world is asking too much of me. Don't people know I only have 24 hours in a day? I've got way too much to do and not enough time to do it." Here's the irony. Let's say you take the victim thinking position, which always leads to fatigue, another irony, and you're sitting there trying to do a task. Let's say your next task is to call Joseph and talk to him about an upcoming project. In your mind, if you're the victim, you're thinking, "I've got to call Joseph, but I've also got about 50 other things to do, and at least 3 things to do within the next 20 minutes. But I'm going to call Joseph anyway, so when I call him, I've got 3 things in the back of my mind that will keep coming to the front of my mind while I'm talking to him." Now Joseph is talking to you, and you're talking and taking a few notes, and then Joseph says something to you, but your mind has drifted to another of the 3 things you have to do in the next 20 minutes. You're not really focusing, and you and he are not advancing anything forward. And finally, you're both kind of frustrated, and you both say, "Hey, let's talk later. Let's get this done at another time. It looks like we need to talk a little more about this, and why don't we talk next week? Maybe if we talk closer to the event, we could get more done. But I'll email you. Why don't you email me? Here's my email address, and I'll get back to you later. And I'll send you some things, and we'll move this forward later." That conversation, because it was not complete, was a waste of your time. All because you weren't focusing when you talked. Now you've postponed what you were going to do in this conversation. And this kind of incomplete activity happens all day. You had so many things going on in your mind that you couldn't relax into a conversation with Joseph in such a way that you got total closure on what you are doing. And now the new future conversation with Joseph has now entered the queue of all these things you have unfinished and left to do. It takes a number and gets in line in your mind, where the lines go around the block now. Now you'll walk around with the thought of, "I need to finish this up with Joseph," in the back of your mind all day, which robs you of energy and makes your next task also very likely to be incomplete, very likely to suffer the same fate that your conversation with Joseph suffered. Soon, all your activities go this way, totally fragmented, lopsided, unfinished, not beautiful, not relaxed, but just a kind of ragged attempt to get through a conversation. We've isolated this one conversation because it's very typical of what we do throughout the day. This can happen 50 times a day when we come from the victim perspective, especially from thinking, "I'm swamped, I'm overwhelmed, I have way too much to do." This victim perspective is the ultimate ineffective time management system. Even if you have long lists of tasks and all sorts of things to delegate, it's still a mess because the chaos is in your own mind, not on paper. The chaos is in your brain. And that's what it looks like on the outside, too, in a world of running around trying to get all this done. There is another way. There is another system. And that's the system we call one thing to do. The ultimate time management system is to only have one thing to do ever. To simply stand over that golf ball and before you put a good stroke on it, know that it's all you have to do, and you'll be a winner. People say, one thing to do? Well, that would be nice. But let's really slow this down and look at it. Remember a time when you had a vacation day and woke up and only had one thing to do that day? You got up out of bed, and maybe the one thing to do was to go to the store and buy a card. You were going to buy a birthday card for someone that day and put it in the mail, but that was the only thing you had to do. Picture how that felt. Picture how beautiful that was. Luxurious, relaxed, wonderful, almost like you owned the world. There's just one thing to do. You can go get that birthday card on your own sweet time. So you have a leisurely breakfast, you sit and look out over the water, and you take a little walk, and when you're good and ready, you get in the car and you go to the market. Then you go to the card store and browse for a little while and think about your friend whose birthday it is. Soon you find a really funny but thoughtful card that you know your friend will like. It reminds you of something that he and you shared a long time ago. You drive home and write out, very carefully, a little message to your friend in the card, something that's touching, something he'll get a kick out of. You put the card in the envelope, address it, put a stamp on it, and put it out next to the front door, on the little bookshelf by the front door. You know it'll get mailed tomorrow, and so your task is over. You've done your one thing. Maybe a week from now, you'll get a call from your friend who says, "Boy, that card was great. It was so funny. It was just wonderful to get it. Thanks for taking the time to get it. It was so thoughtful of you." And your friendship's enhanced, and it feels very good. Doing one thing tends to turn out that way. What if we could live every day this way? What if every day we only had one thing to do? How beautiful would life be? What if our conversation with Joseph was the only thing we had to do back on that day when it was so diffuse and frantic? Let's rewind and look at what that conversation would have been like, played over again. You're about to call Joseph. This time you get some notes together, pull files down, print out a few emails, and then you're sitting there with them, in front of you, feeling well organized. You take a breath before the call and think a little bit about it. You sit in an easy chair, call up Joseph, and ask him if he really has time to talk right now. Joseph says, sure. You say, great. Let's go over this. Let's make sure we finish this up so there's nothing more to do. Joseph says, that would be a wonderful thing. In a very relaxed way, you go through all you want to discuss. You listen very carefully to him, and you're only thinking about this conversation. It's the only thing in the world for you. It's the only thing that exists. You relax so thoroughly into it that you and he come up with some really good ideas. When you hang up, you feel great, just like you feel when you've made a clean hit on the ball. One stroke. You get up from your chair, ready for what's next, whatever that is. You know it'll be the only thing you have to do that day. Pick one thing and do it well. Just one thing. Full focus, full charm, full creativity. Tie it up in a ribbon and send it off as a gift. Well done. Then step into your next thing. Maybe your next thing is nothing. Just the breath you take before your next thing, or the prayer of thanks you offer for being alive to do these things one thing at a time. Maybe your next thing is 10 minutes of planning the future. Soon your future will evolve and emerge like a beautiful flower. People are rewarded for how they do their one thing, not for how many things they worry about. Number 66. Don't get your act together. Pablo Picasso said, quote, Once I drew like Raphael, but it has taken me a lifetime to draw like a child. End quote. Evangeline wanted to offer her services as a trainer to a large organization whose president she met at her children's preschool. His company was one of the largest in the state, and she knew that if she could get a contract there, she would be set for a long time. But when she called us, she was upset. She said, "I can't approach Mr. Johansson. I don't have my act together yet. I can't get myself to go in to see him." That puts you in a good position. What do you mean? You can show up as a real person. You can go in right away with a more charming approach. Just call and say, "I've got to tell you, I don't have my act together, but I want to meet with you. I don't know what I'm doing. I may be insane. This thing I'm going to ask of you, you might throw me out of the office, but all I need is 15 minutes of your time." "Wow, what do I do when I get there?" Well, you might say, "I have no idea how to say this, so I'm just going to blurt it out. I've got the skills and experience to train all of your people, and I can make a huge difference in productivity for you. What I'm requesting is one paid pilot session with you in the room as a witness, and what I can promise is that I won't waste a minute of your time." Evangeline said nothing. "Look, are you committed to serving that person?" She said, "Oh, yeah, I'll serve him till the end of his days." "Great. Just go tell him that and start from there. You don't have to have your act together yet. This is not about artificial manipulation. Just connect. Make your best connection on a human level, no matter how charmingly awkward, and then get inside and go." Evangeline lit up. Previously, she had believed that one always had to have things prepared to perfection before ever asking for anything that involved money. But people are in a hurry. That CEO, Mr. Johansson, she met would appreciate the speed with which she showed up at his office. She took her chance and went right in to see him. She was willing to be vulnerable and real. His heart melted at her enthusiasm for what she could do for his people. He gave her immediate permission to set up a pilot. Evangeline said, "I'm really happy that I'm getting to do the pilot. It was hard to walk in and do that without a lot of detailed preparation, but it was just my energy that won him over." You don't have to always have your act together. You don't always need a polished technique or script. Just trust the basic childish innocence of authentic commitment to serve. Trust that a deep desire to serve someone will always connect, no matter how you say things. As the great German philosopher-poet Goethe said, quote, "Once you learn to trust yourself, you will know how to live." End quote. Number 67. Let someone else do your homework. Jim Rohn said, quote, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." End quote. A lot of people jump into a risky wealth opportunity that they are happy to do by trial and error. Then they fall on their face and wonder what happened. They don't realize that a lot of other people went down that path before, and they know where it ends up. They now know what to do and what not to do. So it can be extremely useful to your wealth curve to prowl and troll and study websites and articles about successful businesses similar to yours in your category. Because people, when they succeed, get excited about how they succeeded. They want to share what they did and what they know. Look through what other people have on their websites. What kinds of things do they offer? What do they charge for it? How does it work? They've done the homework already. If you come across someone that's successful, ask them questions, and they will tell you how they did it. Sam, who owns music and dance studios, was at a seminar once that was full of karate studio owners. He had learned pretty much all the things he could learn from the music and dance studio market, so he wanted to look at a karate studio seminar and see what they knew that he could possibly use. They went around the room, and attendees were asked to say how many students they had and what their gross sales were to introduce themselves. And everyone was saying, I have 150 students, or I have 100, I have 300, I've got 250, and all the typical numbers. And it got around to Sam, and he said, I've got 3,000. And everyone just kind of looked at him. You'd think that the first break that came up, everyone would run over to him and say, what are you doing? How are you doing this? Are you doing direct marketing? But they didn't say a word. It was a room full of karate studio owners, and they were so testosterone-driven and egotistical that they thought, well, what can this dance studio guy tell me? Sam said, and they were all sitting there thinking, well, I can beat the X out of this guy. That's why I don't care if he's more successful than me. But Sam was thinking, I can pay those five guys there to beat the X out of you, so who's more dangerous? Let's go out of the egocentric thinking that says you have to use your own genius to succeed. Stop it with, if I didn't come up with the idea, then it's not my idea. So what? That doesn't mean it isn't a great idea for me to use. It's ego that stops people from letting someone else do their homework. But when you're more committed to success than you are to looking good, you'll get your ideas anywhere you can find them. When you're making your deposit at the bank doesn't care if you did all the work yourself or if someone else helped you. They put the money in your account just as quickly, either way. Number 68. Think open hand. John Bunyan said, quote, a man there was, and they called him mad. The more he gave, the more he had. End quote. If who you are is good, give yourself. If your product is good, give someone the experience of it. Don't be stingy. Keep giving, because what you give, you get. If you have a natural tendency to think in terms of scarcity, you'll shut down the inflow of wealth by choking off the outflow. As you're more able to invest in your people and give yourself to the world, you'll let the money flow in and flow out, and you'll move to wealth much faster. There's a segment in The Nine Lies where we briefly describe the owner-victim syndrome. And because there was an entire book written previously about it, Reinventing Yourself, we just told the reader to email us for a free copy of that book if they wanted to read deeper on the subject. We just opened our hand and offered it. No hidden motive. Many people have emailed us to take advantage of the offer, and we simply gave them the book. We have received more coaching and seminar business from doing that one act than we ever intended up front. We just wanted to give. But it always comes back. As the great spiritual teacher Gurdjieff said, quote, if you help others, you will be helped. Perhaps tomorrow, perhaps in 100 years, but you will be helped. Nature must pay off the debt. It is a mathematical law, and all life is mathematical. End quote. Number 69. Decide to join the millions of millionaires. Stuart Wilde said, quote, there is no defined limit as to how much money you can acquire in what little time. If any definition exists, it does so just in your mind and in your emotions. End quote. In the 1950s, it was a big fantasy dream to be a millionaire. They even had a show called The Millionaire about a rich and powerful man who was a superhero because he was a millionaire. The term millionaire and the connotation haven't really changed, But the ease of getting there certainly has. The world has changed for the better. 100 years ago, if we talked about going to Europe from the U.S., it would be a pretty arduous journey. You'd take a boat, and it would be lengthy and hard. But now, even though Europe is in the same place, and the U.S. is in the same place, the ease of getting back and forth has been simplified by 100 times. The cost is even 10 times less than it was. But a lot of people still have a psychological barrier, so they've never been to Europe. They've never been to Spain. Sam was approached by someone recently who said to him, "Wow, you're a millionaire, wow." Sam recalls, "As I took my monocle off and blew some steam on it and rubbed it against my waistcoat, I said, 'The truth is, it's not really as big a deal as it sounds. I'd like to build the mystique, but a lot of people can do it. There are millions and millions of millionaires, so it definitely can happen to you. Don't think it's a far-off never-never-land goal.'" The old television show The Millionaire was popular on black-and-white TV. In the show, the main hero was a millionaire, and because he was a millionaire, it seemed like he had unlimited wealth. In every episode, he'd decide to come into some dire situation where somebody was financially struggling and give the people money to bail them out. The suggestion was that maybe there's only one millionaire, there's only one Superman, only one Lone Ranger, and there's only one millionaire. It was this same mystique of $1 million that Mike Myers made fun of in Austin Powers, when Dr. Evil puts his finger to his cheek and says, "We will ask them for $1 million. And the joke was that it was way too little of a ransom to ask for if you're going to blow up the whole world. And everyone just howled with laughter. And the whole joke was how little money that really has become. $1 million is just a small number now. One of the fastest tracks to becoming a millionaire is to not have that numerical mystique mean anything intimidating to you. You're a millionaire, so what? Are you fulfilled and having fun? That's what really matters. And ironically, that's usually the road to becoming a millionaire. Number 70. Don't get hooked on win-win. Robert Fritz said, quote, "If you limit your choices only to what seems possible or reasonable, you disconnect yourself from what you truly want, and all that is left is compromise." End quote. The point here is to stop trying to help everyone by discounting your fee and giving them a deal. The win for them is already there if you have a great service. You don't have to add a new win on top of that win. If who you are is great, they have already won by sitting down with you. You don't have to add to their win by cutting some deal with them and helping them out financially. If you're in a negotiation for any contracted services, you don't have to keep pushing money over to the other side of the table to help them out and then cover it with thinking you're trying to go for a win-win. Because if what you have is valuable, they've already won. They're coming in with a win. You don't have to add to that. You need to stand proud and allow yourself to win too, because they've already won just because they're doing business with you. Jim Camp, in our opinion, America's greatest negotiation coach, who wrote the masterpiece Start With No, insists that good negotiators avoid win-win. It makes better sense for both parties, and it guarantees better service when you always sell yourself for what you're really worth. In most cases, win-win should be relabeled as "I chickened out and just gave them a deal, because I really needed to make it. I caved. I linked money to survival. I thought it was a need." Win-win is usually code for wuss-wuss. A poem by J.B. Rittenhouse illustrates this. It's called My Wage, and it goes like this. I bargained with life for a penny, and life would pay no more. However, I begged at evening, when I counted my scanty store. For life is a just employer. He gives you what you ask. But once you have set the wages, why, you must bear the task. I worked for a menial's hire, only to learn dismayed that any wage I had asked of life, life would have paid. Number 71. Think making before saving. Henry Ford said, quote, I think that much of the advice given to young people about saving money is wrong. I never saved a cent until I was 40 years old. I invested in myself, in study, in mastering my tools, in preparation. Many a man who is putting a few dollars a week into the bank would do much better to put it into himself. End quote. People can obsess with guilt about saving money. They can spend huge amounts of time and energy going through the weekly grocery store coupons, the inserts, to figure out how they can save $4 to $5. All that energy could have been spent creating money, calling forth wealth from the universe. We're not saying you should be a fool about things and pay more than you have to, but the exercise of saving, hoarding, and clinging as your primary wealth objectives is dangerous on a couple of levels. First of all, it makes you believe in scarcity. It anchors lack in your belief system. There are only 100 marbles, so I have to make sure I don't give away too many of those because there's only a set amount, so I have to watch every single marble that goes out. I don't want to lose my marbles. The second thing it does is distract you from the bigger opportunity, which is making money. We have a friend we will call Warren, who's a consultant. He's got a nice regular executive job, and he also consults on the side, and he makes an average of $400 an hour consulting. Warren consults with large organizations and individuals alike, but it is nothing for him to spend 2 hours on the weekend trying to find where to get grass seed for $5 less than where he's now getting it. He will look at grass seed at one place and spend the rest of the morning driving to four other places. And then, when he gets one for $5 less, he just cheers with delight, saying, I have just saved us $5. If he had spent one of those lost hours consulting on the phone, he'd be up by $395, but he doesn't see that. His emotions about the scarcity of money are keeping him from abundance. Even if he spent that hour with his little daughter instead of racing from store to store, he'd bring a happier Warren to his work hours next week and be even more successful. And maybe it's fun for him to find that $5 savings. And maybe that plays into some deep psychological wound about money. But we suggest that Warren still has a scarcity mindset running his life that blinds him to his unlimited wealth. Human beings are creators of wealth, or they are not. And this whole program is about how to shift from reacting to creating. Therefore, it is not a very smart activity for your brain to spend half a day chasing down $5. When we pointed out to Warren that he could make a lot more money than he was saving, he said, yeah, but you can't just do work all the time. Well, that's true. And if you're going to save money for the fun and satisfaction of it, and you know that's all you're doing, then that's hard to oppose. But Warren wasn't doing his grass seed crusade in a very light-hearted way. He was serious. You could see the veins standing out on his neck as he drove from one mall to another. Warren was full of stress and anxiety until he found something cheaper. Sam's family has a lady that comes in and cleans every week. When people ask them, "Wow, how do you afford to do that?" Sam replies, "It would cost me a lot more not to have a cleaning lady. House cleaning is a lot cheaper than marriage counseling. To make it a smart move financially, we just have to figure out how to get paid more per hour than I'm paying out for the cleaning." Number 72. Focus on people with money. Henry David Thoreau said, quote, "It is not enough to be busy, so are the ants. The question is, what are we busy about?" End quote. Recent reports have showed that 20% of the people in North America have 47% of the disposable income. That means that there are 1 in 5 people who really don't have to be concerned with your price if they don't want to be. They can purchase something from you if they want to. If you're going to set up a business or offer a service, don't forget that you can focus your service on that very type of customer. Many people don't realize that. People we coach will often say, "Well, I have to be fair to the whole market picture, don't I? Don't I want the whole market to have access to what I do?" Why? Are you a public service? Are you the government? Do you really have to be accessible to every single person? If you're looking to sell yourself or your great product, you may as well go where the money is. It's harder to get money from people who don't have it. While coaching Caroline, who just opened up a practice as a fitness trainer, we asked her to describe her ideal client to us. Where does he live? How old is he? How often would he come in? What does he like? "I don't know," Caroline said. "I don't care. I just need clients." Wrong answer. Caroline failed to see that she could be as creative and intelligent about finding the right clients as she was about developing her fitness expertise. Finally, after we spent some sessions helping her decide who her ideal client would be, Caroline had a number of breakthroughs and exciting ideas about how to jumpstart her business. She started with her ready-made client list and created a powerful referral program that eliminated the need to advertise, market, network, or schmooze. By focusing on people who had greater likelihood of using and affording her services, she bypassed all the trouble people encounter when they're always open for anybody. You can do the same. Number 73. Think small. Mother Teresa said, quote, "Be faithful in small things, because it is in them that your strength lies." End quote. Remember that bigger is not better. Bigger is just bigger. Our friend, and here we'll call him Pierre, was the head of a group of information technology trainers. They worked out of a small rented office with very little overhead, and they were successful training major companies in IT. But soon, Pierre had the urge to get bigger. Expansion for the sake of expansion. Isn't that how the big boys do it? He started plotting the purchase of a massive building. Instead of taking care of current customers, he got hooked on fantasizing about growth. When you went to see Pierre about a customer concern, you saw that he had architect's drawings spread out across his desk all over his office. You tried to bring him back to the present moment, but his head was always in the future. Instead of making the most of his current IT master trainers, course creators, and consultants, he began hiring mediocre surrogates who would learn quickly to parrot the words of the original trainers so his business could get bigger faster. Pierre thought expansion of his business into a bigger building would also be better. But bigger was not better. Bigger became a disaster. The quality of training dropped dramatically. Soon, his top trainers were leaving as they witnessed all the company's money going into all the new expansion, and customers were complaining and not coming back. It wasn't long before Pierre was right back into the failure he had started with. His best people were gone, his best customers were gone, all because he thought bigger was better. You have huge advantages being small. You can move faster. You can pay more special attention to people. You can get to know your customers on a more thorough basis. The list goes on and on. So when you expand, be certain you lose none of those advantages. Because bigger is just bigger. It's not always better. In fact, most of the time, it's worse. Remember the law of supply and demand. When you get bigger, you run the risk of violating this law and having more supply than there is demand for. To be truly successful in your small business, you want to reach the point where demand for what you offer is greater than the supply you have of it. That is the road to riches because it allows you to adjust your price upward to meet the demand. High profit margins first, expansion second. Make sure you keep supply and demand in mind at all times. It's a law that will serve you. Forgetting it is like taking a walk on a skyscraper's rooftop and absent-mindedly forgetting the law of gravity. Supply and demand is why oceanfront property is so expensive. There's only a certain amount of oceanfront, with an ever-increasing demand. Have you bought a house in California on the coast lately? It is why diamonds cost what they do. There's only so much in supply. If you grow bigger too fast, you are no longer a diamond. You are no longer oceanfront. You have too much supply, and that will actually turn business away. You don't want all that availability. You want limitation. Limitation increases value. The bigger you get, the faster you lose that advantage. There's excitement when there's more demand than there is supply. There's excitement in the words sold out or standing room only. What if you took your family to Disneyland and there was no one else there to ride the rides with you? Would the experience be the same? As much as people hate those long lines, they still call Disneyland the happiest place on earth. And part of that feeling is because it sure feels like the whole world wants to be there at once, and Disneyland can barely handle the demand. Harley-Davidson motorcycles profits soared when they ran out of motorcycles and had to put prospective buyers on a waiting list. There's another reason, equally important, why bigger is not better. That reason is your own personal quality of life. Keep asking yourself, why did I want my own business? And your answer will probably center on control and freedom. The bigger you get, the less control you have over your business. Soon you are taking on partners and lenders and people looking over your shoulder every day, watching their money. Pretty soon your independence is gone and you spend all your time answering to others. Why? You thought bigger was better. So stay as small as you want to. Always be full and always be crowded with customers who want your services. That way, you can keep your prices high and select the customers you want and not just accept any customer because of a need. When you get blindly bigger, you generate all kinds of new needs. Base your business on wants, not needs, and you'll realize that small is beautiful. You can grow in profitability without growing in size. Number 74. Sell something today. J. Abraham said, quote, "The fact is, everyone is in sales. Whatever area you work in, you do have clients and you do need to sell." End quote. We have people we've consulted with for the last few years that have terrific ideas, but the problem is they haven't actually made a sale. You can't turn something into wealth if you can't sell it. When Sam and Val started up their small dance studio business, they didn't have a commercial space at first. They started the whole process by renting a room in the community center. They paid $25 to set up a little table there. They didn't even have the venue where they were going to teach their lessons. But after handing out a bunch of flyers, they had 7 people show up. They told those people that to get started at the music studio, there would be a $20 registration fee. And they said, "We'll have to get that today to get you started." And they got 7 people to give them $20. So they now had $140. Sam remembers, "For us to start our business, we knew we had to sell something today. We couldn't just leave it out there like an idea in the future." Many people we know have new ventures they want to start, but they keep pushing into the future because they're worried about charging people money for it. And so they keep wondering, "Who else should I bring into this business?" And, "Do I need to go to some school and get certified?" And they keep creating obstacles for themselves that will put off that fateful day when they might have to sell. But they need to sell something today. That's what launches it. They need to just do it now and start charging for some aspect of it now to break through that mental barrier. I was working with a young consultant we'll call Drew the other day, who said, "What else do I need to do before I start coaching?" He was a very highly qualified person for coaching people, so I said, "You need to coach somebody today and have them send you a retainer fee." And Drew said, "Oh, I just don't feel comfortable doing that. I'm not ready yet. Do you think I should get certified somewhere? Aren't there a lot of coaching schools that would certify me?" I said, "You are certifiable, yes. But Sam and I have coached hundreds of businesses, over 20 Fortune 500 companies, and no one has ever asked us for our certification. The results you get are your certification. You just have to do it. Get on the phone and start